Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Forças Armadas assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiyan yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello, welcome, and thanks for listening to Balcast, a podcast where we invite experts and academics to discuss the rise of autocratic regimes that we are witnessing around the world, especially in countries like India, Brazil, South Africa, and even the United States. We discuss how autocratic leaders rise, how they utilize law to undermine democratic institutions in an attempt to immunize their position and expand their power. Today's episode marks the end of season 1 of Palcast, in which Dr. Fabio has interviewed plenty of very remarkable people who have written extensively on autocratic legalism, how to understand it, and perhaps how to resist it. Before I go ahead and introduce my guest today, let me introduce myself. I'm Ahmed Abdelaziz, a student at the University of Oklahoma. I usually help in the post-production process of this episode, but since it's a special episode, I'll be your host today because the usual host, Dr. Fabio, is actually my guest. I thought it might be a good idea to have Dr. Fabio here to tell us more about the podcast and the process of making it. Welcome, Dr. Fabio. How's it going?
Doing great, Ahmed. Very happy to be here with you.
I'm very happy that you are here as well. So I guess our first question today is, why Palcast? Why did you want to start this podcast?
Thanks, Ahmed. I would say that this all began because I needed to map the literature on autocratic legalism. We were starting the project and we needed to ground the project in the literature. And I began to search for works that spoke about our core subject matter. And that is whether and how law is used by rising autocrats to consolidate their power. And it turns out that the literature was very scarce and fragmented, which is really not unusual, especially when we deal with new topics or phenomena. We have to collect whatever pieces of information are available on those topics or phenomena, and these pieces may differ in the extent to which or the depth with which they cover those topics or phenomena. But we have to collect them, we have to make sense of them, and we have to position our work in a way that it will offer a contribution to what's out there about those topics or phenomena. So I was just doing that, you know, something very ordinary in scholarship, but as I was doing it, and perhaps because my sources were so fragmented and sometimes incomplete and contradictory, I thought I actually need to talk to these people. And again, this is kind of the bread and butter of academic work. Usually what we do in academic work is we read, we write, we talk to peers about what we wrote, and we rewrite what we wrote. But here is where I think a second motivation came in, which was the pandemic. Because the pandemic, on one hand, it limited our ability to meet with our peers in conferences or in-person workshops, which is usually where we get our work done. But on the other hand, people were all at home, which doesn't mean that they were, you know, that they had a lot of free time. But I could ask them to squeeze in a Zoom meeting, and I took my chance. I began to reach out saying, listen, I'm part of this project that's just starting. I found your work to be relevant to what we are discussing and to what we want to look at. And I wonder if you could give me a chance to talk to you about your work, to ask some questions and exchange some ideas. But then I developed another thought or motivation, which was to make these conversations available to others, not only those in our research team, but even beyond that, turning those conversations into something that they could listen to, share with their friends and students, broadening the impact of my research efforts to use the language that, for example, the National Science Foundation has adopted. And at this point, I thought, Okay, I'm speaking of a podcast here. Had second and third thoughts because, you know, it can be very scary to think that you're in the business of podcasting all of a sudden. But eventually I decided that I wanted to go for that.
Oh, that's great. I mean, as a student, I'm always a big fan of the idea of publicizing academics because often I'm required to do some readings for my classes. And it kind of annoys me sometimes when it's very complicated and full of jargon. I would really love to have every single reading in my classes to be in a podcast form where I can listen to while walking around. So I know that making podcasts sometimes is like, it could be, it sounds like an easy thing. It's kind of like a friendly conversation with people. However, I believe there must be something challenging about it. So my second question would be, what was challenging about doing this podcast?
Oh yeah, there are many. First, I must say that we have to read a lot. I usually, to prepare for an episode, I spend maybe an entire week reading through the works of these authors and drafting questions I want to raise for them, considering also that this is not an open-ended conversation. It's rather a semi-structured and timed conversation. So while we do have many chances to sidetrack, which we take, there are things that I want to make sure I will address because of their heuristic value. So it's a hard balance to achieve, which requires a lot of preparation, maybe more preparation than a class, definitely more preparation than a conference presentation. Second, in my case, is language. You know, I'm not a native speaker, and students don't usually believe me when I say that language can be a barrier for me. But the truth is that I learned English very late in life. I did not have the chance to study abroad or even to travel until maybe it was close to my 30s. I did not have YouTube and English podcasts to listen to or to watch videos when I was growing up. And learning a language later in life makes it more difficult. Not because you can't learn it, but because you police yourself so much that it takes a while to get comfortable speaking that other language. And, you know, when I'm in a face-to-face conversation, like in the classroom setting, I always have the chance to rephrase a sentence or to explain myself better. On a podcast episode, forget about it. I have to be very, you know, surgical in what I'm saying to get what I want to get from the interviewee. So that's definitely another challenge. And lastly, there's technology. We like to joke that in the pandemic, every university professor had to become something like a YouTuber, scripting, recording, editing videos, and so on. And the same was true for me for podcasting. From, you know, buying a microphone and recording an audio that sounds clear, some things that you gave me advice on, to creating an attractive description for an episode when uploading it to a platform. All these things take up a lot of our time, and they have a learning curve that can be very steep.
Yeah, definitely. It's fascinating how like every professor had to be a content creator all of a sudden in one semester. I appreciate you guys doing this. So I know that you like listening to podcasts. We spoke before about the podcast that we enjoy listening to. But when you are making a podcast, do you still enjoy doing it, or is it only like the challenging part that haunts you?
Totally enjoy. I get to learn a lot from every interview that I make. For the next, I would say, couple weeks after the episode has been recorded and during production time, I keep thinking about the exchange that I had with the interviewee, you know, the questions that I posed, the answers that they gave, things that they did not answer, at least from my viewpoint. If there's anything that keeps hunting me after an interview, is the memory and a certain sense of privilege that I derive from these incredible intellectual exchanges. It also excites me the fact that these interviews do produce the kind of broader impact that I was seeking when I put this project together. I think this week we just surpassed the 600 listens mark, if you will, which I think is a pretty decent number. And I get emails or tags on Twitter from listeners thanking me for the interviews, wanting to learn more about the authors or concepts that were debated on a given episode. Recently, a student here from our university emailed me wanting to be in touch with an interviewee who does work about the country that she's studying. So I feel like I'm accomplishing a lot here, learning a lot on a personal level, connecting dots intellectually, but also connecting with people and connecting people to one another. It pays off for sure.
So speaking about the learning that happens when you have conversations with such remarkable people, academics and experts from all over the world, was there a single episode or a time or an interview that you felt like, I've learned something new this episode, that was a revealing, you know, of some sort?
I wouldn't say that it's in the interview specifically. I would say that it's in the entire process, from getting to read the works from these authors, you know, closely enough to be able to not only grasp their central argument, but also to spot points that beg for further clarification or things that are absent from their works, to drafting the questions and having the chance to present them with the questions. I definitely learn a lot, and, you know, I think I help move the debate forward too. As you know, the way I usually do this, or at least the way I did it in the first season, was to structure the interview in two or three moments. The first moment would be giving the authors a chance to share the basics of their work, because the audience isn't necessarily familiar with their works. And sometimes I nudge them into aspects of their work that are more important for a project on autocratic legalism, but I give them enough space to make their case, so to speak. The second moment then would be where I actually challenge these authors, asking questions that may be harder for them to answer, things that they haven't written about or that I don't entirely agree with what they have written. And third, we usually talk about a topic that I find to be illuminating beyond or besides their more strict contribution to debates on autocratic legalism. So, for example, one thing that I made sure to ask to the two female scholars that I hosted was how gender comes into play, not just in the phenomenon of autocratic legalism, but also in the study of it. So, what is it like to be a woman studying this strong man, or how are gender roles part of autocratic legalism, if at all? And this entire process is revealing in terms of the knowledge that it enables me to extract from these authors, but also, again, as I said before, to help move the conversation forward. To give you an example, one thing that bothered me when I was reading the more fundamental works on this use of law by autocrats to consolidate their power was that a lot of times this was presented as something new and as something typical of our current backsliding democracies. I became increasingly convinced that this was not the case, that this had been done before in other regimes and even in consolidated democracies. So there is something in the relationship between law and politics that makes law susceptible to being used against liberal democracy. And this is what we have to discover. And this is a point that I began bringing up in these conversations, testing the waters for the argument, if you will. And it is a point that I'm now making in one of my written works to PAL.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I've listened to all the episodes, and I've always seen, always enjoyed the conversation that happens between you and the other professors or experts.
Well, since you said that, let me steal some of the show here, and let me ask you a question then. Maybe that's a host complex that I can't get past. Anyway, forgive me for that, but you were with me working on the production of these episodes. And as such, you were also a first-hand consumer of all the knowledge that we were producing here through the podcast. What was it like for you to be in that position?
Well, it was absolutely fascinating for me to kind of see how academics work in a bigger level, where like different experts and professors are kind of communicating together and producing some sort of literature, right? I've never been engaged in the process of making literature. I've been reading it, I've been consuming it in different ways, but not really engaged in the process of making it. So I learned a lot about that. Regarding the post-production and learning from the episodes themselves, I think it was different for me from any other listener, just because I listened to like a single episode like 10 times or something. I keep listening to him again and again and again because I'm editing, so I have to cut stuff and I have to add things, and then I have to improve the quality, etc. So I feel like I've become an expert at this point with the amount of time I've listened to these episodes. I'm kidding. I still have a lot to learn, but it was actually a very fun process to kind of just take all of this long conversation and then cut it down to an episode that someone can consume while like driving to work. And aside from learning about the topic itself and about like legalism and about the writings of all of those great authors, I think I also learned a lot about editing as well and sound designing. That was also helpful for me to kind of sharpen my technical skills. So yeah, it was a great opportunity.
That's great to hear. But you know, you run the show today, so I'll give you the floor back and you can proceed however you want.
So I guess that moves us to our next question, which is, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Yes, I was talking about female scholars, and one thing I want to do is to host more female scholars in the more diverse, say, cast in season two. One of the reasons why I extended season one for so long was because I wanted to host Kim Shapley on the show, and I explained this on the episode that we had scheduled the interview for last spring. And then there was this big snowstorm in the United States, which left both of us without internet and power for a couple of days. So my plans were frustrated in that regard. But Kim is a very central person in this conversation. She's the scholar who popularized the term autocratic legalism in Law and Society studies. It was her speech in the 2019 Law and Society meeting that got me and others into this. And to me, it was just unacceptable not to have on a podcast on autocratic legalism the main scholar in this field who's a female. So I did everything that I could. I kept sending her emails and trying to accommodate her schedule, which is very busy and became even busier after the snowstorm and still under the pandemic. But the bottom line here is I definitely want to give more voice to women and non-white scholars on the show. And, you know, being part of academia and recognizing how academia can be hierarchical and hostile toward women and minorities, I think it's also part of my job to try to make things more equal.
Yeah, definitely. So speaking about future plans, what should we expect from season two?
Thank you. This is a great question. You know, we make plans and we sometimes have to change those plans. This is something that we all learned through COVID. But right now, my plans for season two involve three things. One is I want to bring in people who are actually doing most of the work in our project, those who are involved in the empirical studies that we have conducted so far. Season two was largely designed as a space for them and for their research findings to be shared with our audience. So listeners should be ready to run into scholars like Raquel Pimenta from FGV Law School in São Paulo, who's leading the Brazil Country Study, Deepa Das Acevedo from the University of Alabama Law School, who's leading the India Country Study, and Dee Smythe from the University of Cape Town Law School, who's leading the South Africa Country Study. Three females. I also want to bring in some scholars from the Law and Society Association who are involved in the process of turning PAL into a global collaborative project, the first of this kind in that association. One of those scholars is Dee Smythe, who I mentioned, and who's the coordinator for global activities in the association. And I'll bring a couple of others from the association's International Activities Committee. Finally, I still want to bring in a couple of experts to the show. I think there are certain topics that still deserve some deeper conversation and scrutiny, and they're going to be helping us through that. There are some interesting names lined up, but I'm not going to give spoilers to listeners yet.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess that was the last question I have. So I'm gonna open it up for you and ask you to share anything you have about this project or if you have any questions.
Thanks. I will take this as an opportunity to walk listeners through everything that we are doing. I guess most listeners have been following what's more of an intellectual conversation when we are actually doing a number of things with that intellectual repertoire that they get a taste of here. The first thing to notice is that PAL has done a lot in terms of country research. We developed studies about Brazil, India, and South Africa. The Brazil study is leading to an entire book, which will be published in Portuguese and English. There are essays summarizing or giving the state of the art of autocratic legalism in those three countries, which are going to be the basis of a special issue of the World Comparative Law Journal to be published next year. I wrote a conceptual essay that was just accepted for publication in the Annual Review of Law and Social Science. And there's an interview-based symposium specifically on India, which is forthcoming next year in the Jindal Global Law Review. We are also starting new research, which involves more direct comparisons in BISA. So we are selecting some themes and recruiting new researchers to work on those themes across the three countries. PAL, as I mentioned, has been selected as the inaugural, they call it topical laboratory, in the Law and Society Association's Global Collaborative Program, which is going to give us some resources to really push forward that kind of comparative and collaborative research with Global South and Global North scholars. Then there's the podcast with 8 episodes, counting this one and a second season being planned. And maybe one last thing to say is that we are also getting support from our university. So both the Vice Presidency for Research and Partnerships at OU and the College of International Studies have given me a few grants to support me in the project. And to recognize that support, I offered to feature some ads from OU on the show, which I'm sure are going to entertain our listeners and will also make this sound more serious and professional. So great things happening, good studies being produced, and everybody in the project is very excited about these outcomes.
That sounds very interesting. I'm really looking forward for season two, and I just wanted to say thank you for all our listeners, and thank you, Dr. Fev, for being here.
Yeah, you bet. If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, feel free to contact me at fabio.desaiasilva@ou.edu.